So this is the second installment of Majjhima Nikaya 36, the Mahasatsrika Sutta, the Great Discourse to Satsrika. And just to remind you again very briefly what's going on here, this is the Buddha is having like a debate with this fellow called Satsrika. And what they are debating, the Buddha, Satsrika is saying, talking about development of body and development of mind. And the Buddha is pointing out what these things actually mean in Buddhism and how they are different in Buddhism from how they were defined in India at the time. Because in India at the time, development of the body basically meant ascetic practices, whereas for Buddhism, development of the body was sense restraint and mindfulness. In other words, you are using your senses in such a way you're avoiding to give rise to desire and aversion to the things around you that come through your senses. That's what sense restraint really is all about. And Buddha says to Satsrika that he has ever since he ordained, he says, he has never been overwhelmed in the mind by painful feelings or by happy feelings. In other words, by overwhelmed means that he has kept his sense restraint. He has never allowed these things to take over his mind to the point where he loses his mindfulness, loses his clarity and understanding. That's what what this is about. And just briefly, before I start, I want to just talk briefly about one of the questions that was raised last time, and that was about mindfulness and sense restraint. And the question was, one of the questions was, even if you have like desire for something, let's say, I think he said that if you have like you enjoying the sunshine and you have desire for that sunshine, even if you have that desire, surely it is mindfulness there while you're having that desire. You're enjoying the sunshine. You're sort of focusing on that particular sensual pleasure. And the same thing, of course, if you have a nice meal, some really nice food, sometimes it's easy to focus and be very clear about what you're doing. In other words, your mindfulness is actually quite strong at that point because of that sensual pleasure that you're enjoying it. So mindfulness is there. So is there really a problem? And the answer is yes, there is a problem because it is mindfulness, but it's not right mindfulness. And that is the distinction I should have made last time, but I didn't do that. Because right mindfulness arises from right effort. And one of the important aspects of right effort is sense restraint, not allowing yourself to be attracted or repelled by the sensory object. In other words, you stand back and you have a sense of equanimity and peace with what you're doing instead of allowing the mind to be attracted or repelled by what's happening. And it's that mindfulness, the mindfulness which comes from right effort, where you're standing back and you're watching with a sense of peace and equanimity, that is the mindfulness you want. And that is the mindfulness which then leads on to Sama Samadhi, right Samadhi, and then eventually on to liberation. And the reason for that, of course, is that if you allow yourself to be overwhelmed by desire or aversion for what you are experiencing, then your perception of what's going on is distorted. You can't see things clearly anymore. So it doesn't lead towards that ability to see things clearly, which is actually where you want to go eventually, particularly through Samadhi, Sama Samadhi. So that, I think, is the answer to that question, hopefully, about sense restraint that we were talking about last time. And now the Buddha goes on. He has just mentioned to Satsrika, he has said how three similes occurred to him. And these three similes are all about sensual desire. And he's basically saying that through these similes, he's saying that you have to be away from sensual desires physically, and you also have to be away from them mentally. In other words, there's this twofold aspect to being away from sensual desire. And it's only when you are away from them mentally that your mind has the ability to see things properly and you can make a deep spiritual breakthrough, such as the Arya, becoming an Arya. And then having made that point that it's important to be secluded from sensual pleasures, he goes on to talk about the ascetic practices that he did before his enlightenment. Yes. Sorry, okay. Yeah, I should tell you that. We are on page 337. paragraph 20. Yeah. Okay, and this is what the Buddha said. Page 337, paragraph 20. And the Buddha says, I thought, suppose, with my teeth clenched and my tongue pressed against the roof of my mouth, I beat down, constrain, and crush mind with mind. So, with my teeth clenched, my tongue pressed against the roof of my mouth, I beat down, constrained, and crushed mind with mind. While I did so, sweat ran from my armpits, just as a strong man might seize a weaker man by the head or shoulders, and beat him down, constrain him, and crush him. So too, with my teeth clenched and my tongue pressed against the roof of my mouth, I beat down, constrained, and crushed mind with mind, and sweat ran from my armpits. But although tireless energy was aroused in me, and unremitting mindfulness was established, my body was overwrought and uncalm because I was exhausted by the painful striving. But such painful feeling that arose in me did not invade my mind and remain. So this is a particular type, I guess, of ascetic practice. He's trying to control his mind, using his own mind, using willpower. This is all about willpower, it seems, this particular paragraph. Using willpower to control his mind in various ways. I think the translation here of exhausted was uncalm because I was exhausted by the painful striving. I'm not sure if that is the best translation. I think it's more correct to say he was uncalm because I was afflicted or struck by the painful striving. Because just before he said that tireless energy was aroused. So if you have tireless energy, you're probably not exhausted at the same time. It seems to be slightly contradictory there. So I think afflicted by the painful striving is probably better. So the point that he is making here is that although he was practicing in this way, he kept his mindfulness at all times, so that unremitting mindfulness was established. And it's because that unremitting mindfulness is established, that is why the painful feeling that arose did not invade his mind and remain. In other words, it's mindfulness in the end that makes sense restraint possible. When a painful feeling invades your mind and remains, it means that it becomes something that you have like aversion to, something that you attach to, something you hold on to, and you lose that sense of distance. Whereas when you have clear mindfulness, strong mindfulness, that is when you are always able to see the arising of that aversion, of that negativity, and you can actually stop it before it enters the mind. So these things go together, mindfulness and sense restraint. It is one of those catch-22 situations, because on the one hand, on the Eightfold Path, you need to have sense restraint to get mindfulness, but at the same time, for mindfulness to be perfected, for sense restraint to be perfected, you have to have mindfulness first of all. So it's almost like these two build up together. You restrain yourself, the senses, and then that increases the mindfulness. And by being mindful, you actually improve your ability at sense restraint. So they grow together like that. But perfection of sense restraint only happens when mindfulness is established. Yes, Bhutto. Yes. I think he's not avoiding the pain. I think he's just seeing the pain with mindfulness. He's watching the pain with mindfulness. It's like an ascetic practice, but you watch it with mindfulness, but you don't actually allow it to take over the mind in the sense whereby you are actually swamped by the pain or you become completely obsessed by it or anything like that. You're just watching it in a peaceful, equanimous way. You just see pain, pain, pain. And that's it. I think that's what it means. It is very superhuman, but it is a kind of practice that you sometimes hear about in like the Thai forest tradition, for example. They would sometimes use these kind of practices, like pain practice, whereby you sit and sit and sit and sit, and you watch the pain as it arises. And if you're able to do that, that's what they say, I don't do this kind of thing, but if you are able to do that, there comes a point after many hours of pain where suddenly everything just vanishes and you go into a state of samadhi. But the only way you can do that is if you are constantly mindful of the pain and you don't allow yourself to become averse or negative to it. You're just watching it and then eventually it disappears. So that seems to be a similar kind of practice as to what is happening here. Yes. I don't think that the Buddha actually recommended this practice. It's not actually in the suttas. It's not part of his teaching, the Buddha's teaching. It was something he did prior to his enlightenment. And I think it can give such results. But I don't think it actually is something that you want to do, because normally it has the opposite effect. Because normally, as it says here, it says that my body was overwrought and uncalm because I was afflicted by the painful striving. And it says elsewhere, if you go to Majjhima 19, the Dvaita-vitakka Sutta, two kinds of thought, it says there that when your body is tired and afflicted in this way, it's difficult to concentrate the mind. In other words, you can't usually concentrate the mind. And then I think this is the problem here for the Buddha. Basically, concentration becomes difficult at this stage. And excuse me. And later on in the same sutta, you will see that the Buddha, once he realizes that this particular path is not actually working properly, he starts to take solid food again, and he abandons that ascetic practice precisely because it does not actually lead to the jhanas and samadhi. So I think in the case of the Thai forest tradition, they seem to have had some success with that. But, what level of samadhi they actually reached, whether it was jhana or what it was, it's all very uncertain because of their very idiosyncratic way of teaching the Dhamma. You never really know exactly what it is that they have attained or where they have gone. So I think that basically, my sense when I read the suttas is that that is not the kind of recommended way that the Buddha said to practice samadhi or attain samadhi. It may be possible, but I don't think it is what the Buddha would have recommended. We don't see these things in the suttas. So. Is that what you were asking? I wasn't. Yeah? Yeah? Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, so that is the thing here, that this, even though he was able to remain mindful, and even though he was able to keep his sense restraint, still, this kind of practice does not actually lead to samadhi. And that is what you find in the two kinds of thoughts, the Dvaita-vitakka Sutta. Okay, so that is the first ascetic practice. And then it goes on with a whole series of ascetic practices here. So we'll just read through them. I thought, suppose I practice breathless meditation. So I stopped the in-breaths and the out-breaths through my mouth and nose. While I did so, there was a loud sound of winds coming out from my ear holes. Just as there is a loud sound when the smith's bellows are blown, so too, while I stopped the in-breaths and out-breaths through my nose and mouth, it says ears, it should be mouth, there was a loud sound of winds coming out through my ear holes. But although tireless energy was aroused in me, and unremitting mindfulness was established, my body was overwrought and uncalm, because I was afflicted by the painful striving. But such painful feelings that arose in me did not invade my mind and remain. Now, one of the interesting points in this particular paragraph is, he says here, suppose I practice the breathless meditation. Now, the Pali word for the breathless meditation is the apanaka jhana. Apanaka means like without breath, and jhana is just the word jhana that we know about. And of course here, it does not mean jhana in the sense of the four jhanas. Here, what we have here is a usage of the word jhana the way it was used before the Buddha started to give his teachings. So here you get some sense of how jhana was used before the Buddha's enlightenment. It had a much wider sense of kind of some kind of control of the body, or some kind of ascetic practice even, some kind of meditation that was not the four jhanas. And this is an interesting pointer, because it points again to the fact that the Buddha used a lot of the vocabulary that was already existing in India at the time, that was used in Brahmanical circles, that was used by the Jains, by used by others, and he used that vocabulary and he gave it new meaning. And that is an interesting and I think an important point when you read the suttas. And that can solve some of the dilemmas that you sometimes find by certain passages and things. Anyway, I won't get into that now, just to keep that in mind. excuse me. Eventually, he would die. Yeah. So I guess he stopped it for a certain amount of time before he took it up again. So, yeah. It's a good question. I guess it was one of the accepted practices of the day. I guess that he would just, you know, probably picked it up from somewhere. I guess it was, he was trying to somehow subdue the body and attain some superhuman state. That was the purpose of all these things. So I guess he thought that if I do this, maybe I can attain some kind of state or something. That was the purpose. Yeah. Yes. Well, that's what he seems to be saying. What he says in this sutta, that's what he seems to be saying. Ever since he went forth into the ascetic life, he seems to have had perfect sense restraint. That's what he seems to be saying here. I don't know. I mean, that's what it says here. Whether that actually is the case, or whether that is in a kind of a later glorification of the Buddha or what, but that's what he seems to be saying here in this particular sutta. So obviously he had very good spiritual faculties from the start. That is controversial. That is, I know that Ajahn Brahm likes that theory. Ajahn Brahm says that he was a stream entry. He reckons that the Buddha may have been a stream entry from the moment he was from a past life. But it's a very interesting theory, and I'm not saying it's wrong, but I don't think it's certain either that actually is the case. I think that just Ajahn Brahm sometimes likes to throw a cat among the pigeons and see what happens. Other monks do as well, huh? Yeah, yeah. Yeah. Is it there? That's true, huh? But that is another, that sutta where he says that, that's the Acharya Buddha Sutta, I imagine 127, to 123 or whatever. And that sutta is quite a late sutta. It's spoken by Ananda. It is very different in the Chinese version. It has a lot of because it's a very kind of almost like a supernatural sutta. Many of the elements that are very supernatural. And you will find that it's interesting that it is so different in the Chinese, because it seems to me that many of the elements, they were added later, and as time went by, people sort of said, oh, the Buddha had this, he had that, okay, better add it into the sutta in that case, you know, that sort of thing. Yeah. So I'm not sure how reliable that sutta is. It's the only place where the Buddha said such a thing. Yeah. But yeah, it's an interesting theory. I never discard anything Ajahn Brahm says or discount it. But I still feel that even Ajahn Brahm, it's a theory on his part. It's not something that he knows. You know, it's just his idea. And for that reason, I think one is allowed to sort of be open-minded about whether it actually is the case or not. So that's the way I look at that one there. Okay, so he then goes on with further ascetic practices. I thought, suppose I practice further the breathless meditation. So I stopped the in-breaths and the out-breaths through my mouth, nose, and ears. While I did so, violent winds cut through my head, just as if a strong man was splitting my head open with a sharp sword. So too, while I stopped the in-breaths and out-breaths through my mouth, nose, and ears, violent winds cut through my head. But although tireless energy was aroused in me and unremitting mindfulness was established, my body was overwrought and calm because I was afflicted by the painful striving. But such painful feeling that arose in me did not invade my mind and remain. I thought, suppose I practice further the breathless meditation. So I stopped the in-breaths and out-breaths through my mouth, nose, and ears. While I did so, there were violent pains in my head, just as if a strong man were tightening a tough leather strap around my head as a headband. So too, while I stopped the in-breaths and out-breaths through my mouth, nose, and ears, there were violent pains in my head. But although tireless energy was aroused in me, and unremitting mindfulness was established, my body was overwrought and calm because I was afflicted by the painful striving. But such painful feeling that arose in me did not invade my mind and remain. And he continues, I thought, suppose I practice further the breathless meditation. So I stopped the in-breaths and out-breaths through my mouth, nose, and ears. While I did so, violent winds carved up my belly, just as if a skilled butcher or his apprentice were to carve up an ox's belly with a sharp butcher's knife. So too, while I stopped the in-breaths and out-breaths through my mouth, nose, and ears, violent winds carved up my belly. But although tireless energy was aroused in me, and unremitting mindfulness was established, my body was overwrought and uncalm, because I was afflicted by the painful striving. But such painful feeling that arose in me did not invade my mind and remain. I thought, suppose I practice further the breathless meditation. So I stopped the in-breaths and out-breaths through my mouth, nose, and ears. While I did so, there was a violent burning in my body, just as if two men were to seize a weaker man by both arms and roast him over a pit of hot coals. So too, while I stopped the in-breaths and out-breaths through my mouth, nose, and ears, there was a violent burning in my body. But although tireless energy was aroused in me, and unremitting mindfulness was established, my body was overwrought and uncalm, because I was afflicted by the painful striving. But such painful feeling that arose in me did not invade my mind and remain. So the point of all this is basically just to show that the Buddha has pretty much gone through, not the Buddha to be, has gone through pretty much all types of painful feelings that are possible to go through. He has done it all. And in all of those cases, his sense restraint was established and he didn't allow it to invade his mind and remain. And this is important for what follows afterwards. So just see what happens afterwards. Now, when deities saw me, some said, the recluse Gautama is dead. Other deities said, the recluse Gautama is not dead, he is dying. Another deity said, the recluse Gautama is not dead nor dying, he is an arahant, for such is the way arahants abide. So it seems that the meaning here seems to be that he was holding his breath for so long that some people thought he was dead, basically. Yes, sir. It's a very good question. I was wondering about myself when I read this. You know, is this original? Is this really in there? What is the evidence? Is there any other evidence in the suttas that the Buddha to be actually saw deities? And I don't know. Sometimes I'm a little bit skeptical about these kind of passages. But it's there. So because it's there, it might have happened. Unfortunately, this particular sutta doesn't have a full parallel sutta in the Chinese Agamas. So it's hard to actually compare these things. Well, I mean, it depends on the kind of society. I mean, if you have a spiritual society where people do lots of meditation and maybe they gain states of samadhi and these kind of things, if that is a general norm in society, then you can expect that there will be some people among those who do have see supernormal things, you know, because that's one of the results of samadhi practice. So for that reason, it may have been, I mean, I think in our modern society, there has never really been all that much, you know, spiritual practice of that kind, of that type. You know, it is said that there were some Christian mystics in the Middle Ages. I'm talking about kind of European culture, now Western culture. It's said that there were some mystics who did attain samadhi states. But generally speaking, the real art of meditation is an Indian thing. It's in India where they did this kind of thing here. And it's an Indian cultural thing here. So because of that, it may have been that in that culture, it was known precisely because that was part of the culture here. So maybe that is the reason. Yeah, that's right, yeah. I think that's basically it. I think for them it was quite natural. It wasn't such a, you know, wasn't a big deal, you know. Yeah. Yeah. That the deity is... Yeah, yeah, yeah. I know that story of the sage Asita. He said that there was somebody. That is from, I think that is a, what is that? Is it the Sutta Nipata or something? Is it? It's another sutta which, you know, you can argue about that. I don't think it exists. These are kind of more legendary things, I think, and I don't think that there is any much reason to believe that particular declaration is. I don't know. As far as I know, it is one of those uncertain things in the suttas. I don't think it exists. Remember that the Sutta Nipata does not exist in its full version in the Agamas. There's only parts of the Sutta Nipata that exist in the Agamas, and that is the two last chapters of that particular book. The rest do not exist there. So, there are other parts that exist there as well, but it's not as a whole. So some of these things, I don't know that exact detail, but some of these things are slightly uncertain, basically. So, yeah. Anyway, let's move on now. These deities say this about the Buddha, and then the Buddha practices on them. I thought, suppose I practice entirely cutting off food. Then deities came to me and said, good sir, do not practice entirely cutting off food. If you do so, we shall infuse heavenly food into the pores of your skin, and you will live on that. I considered, if I claim to be completely fasting, while these deities infuse heavenly food into the pores of my skin, and I live on that, then I shall be lying. So I dismissed those deities, saying, there is no need. And then he decides that he's going to take a little bit of food at least. So he thinks the following. I thought, suppose I take very little food, a handful each time, whether of bean soup, or lentil soup, or vetch soup, or pea soup. So I took very little food, a handful each time, whether of bean soup, lentil soup, vetch soup, or pea soup. When I did so, my body reached a state of extreme emaciation. Because of eating so little, my limbs became like the jointed segments of a vine stems or bamboo stems. Because of eating so little, my backside became like a camel's hoof. Because of eating so little, the projections of my spine stood forth like corded beads. Because of eating so little, my ribs jutted out as gaunt as the crazy rafters of an old roofless barn. Because of eating so little, the gleam of my eyes sank far down into their sockets, looking like the gleam of water that has sunk far down in a deep well. Because of eating so little, my scalp shriveled and withered, as a green bitter gourd shrivel and withers in the wind and sun. Because of eating so little, my belly skin adhered to my backbone. Thus, if I touched my belly skin, I encountered my backbone. And if I touched my backbone, I encountered my belly skin. Because of eating so little, if I defecated and urinated, I fell over on my face right there. Because of eating so little, if I tried to ease my body by rubbing my hands, rubbing my limbs with my hands, the hair rotted at its roots, fell from my body as I rubbed. So basically what he's saying here is that he's taking these ascetic practices, not eating, to its absolute extreme. That is what basically this is about. And it is pretty extreme, the sort of things that is described here. So then he goes on. Now, when people saw me, some said, the recluse Gautama is black. Other people said, the recluse Gautama is not black, he is brown. Other people said, the recluse Gautama is neither black nor brown, he is golden skin. So much had the clear, bright color of my skin deteriorated through eating so little. So I guess the point there is that his skin had become black, but some people still remembered him the way he was before, or something like that. That's probably the point. I thought, whatever recluses or Brahmins in the past have experienced painful, racking, piercing feelings due to exertion, this is the utmost. There is none beyond this. And whatever recluses and Brahmins in the future will experience painful, racking, piercing feelings due to exertion, this is the utmost. There is none beyond this. And whatever recluses and Brahmins at present experience painful, racking, piercing feelings due to exertion, this is the utmost. There is none beyond this. But by this racking practice of austerities, I have not attained any superhuman state, and a distinction in knowledge and vision worthy of the noble ones. Could there be another path to enlightenment? So, what he is saying here is that he has taken these ascetic practices as far as it is possible. He has experienced painful feeling as much as it is possible to experience painful feeling through this kind of practices. And he has not thereby attained the goal. So, of course, the conclusion then is, if you're taking it to its extreme and you haven't got it, the conclusion is it doesn't work. And that is where he's getting at now. So now you see he has rejected, on the one hand, sensual pleasures as not working, and on the other hand, he has rejected austerities as not working here. And that's why he now, his choices are starting to narrow down. And he's starting to ask, well, what other way might there be if none of these two actually work? And that is why he has described, I think, these austerities in such racking, in such enormous detail here, because he wants to make the point that he really has taken these things to the actual, to the complete extreme, that there isn't anything beyond that. That is the point that is being made here, I think. So then, having asked this question, could there be another path to enlightenment? He says, I considered. I recall that when my father, the Sakyan, was occupied, while I was sitting in the cool shade of a rose apple tree, quite secluded from sensual pleasures, secluded from unwholesome states, I entered upon and abided in the first jhana, which is accompanied by applied and sustained attention, I prefer rather than thought, with rapture and pleasure born of seclusion. Could that be the path to enlightenment? Then, following on that memory, came the realization, this is the path to enlightenment. So this is a very powerful statement right there on what the path to enlightenment is. And the implication, of course, that later on, when he talks about the path to enlightenment, he talks about the Noble Eightfold Path is the middle way between sensuality and ascetic practice and self-mortification. And here the jhanas stand in place for that Noble Eightfold Path and the Middle Way. So the jhanas essentially are the middle way, because within the jhanas, if they are practiced correctly according to the middle way, they carry with them also the other seven factors of the Noble Eightfold Path. So the jhana is always going to be the middle way in its own right, because it takes with it all the other ones. Now there is a note here at the back, which I will show you the danger sometimes of reading the notes too much. Because this note at the back here says, this passage marks, this note 390, is that this passage marks a change in the Bodhisattva's evaluation of pleasure. It's actually a note for slightly further down. Now it is no longer regarded as something to be feared and banished by the practice of austerities, but when born of seclusion and detachment, then the pleasure is seen as a valuable accompaniment of the higher stages along the path to enlightenment. And that is what that note says. But what the sutta says, and I think this is very important to keep that in mind, the sutta says this is the path to enlightenment. Now, a valuable accompaniment and a path to enlightenment are two very different things. And this is why one has to be careful sometimes when one reads these things. One has to actually keep one's eyes open for what the text is saying here, and not always buy into what other people say, what the commentaries say, what the notes at the back of the book say, etc. And then sometimes you can actually see these kind of discrepancies and dangers that prop up. And of course, it is not malicious or anything like that. That's not why people write these things. It's simply the way the world is. You can't get everything right all the time. You always make mistakes. And I'm sure many of the things that I say here, in a few years' time, I'm going to think, gee, did I say that? That was a rather stupid thing to say. And that's okay. We evolve, we develop further, and we see things differently here. Okay. So the Buddha has now discovered what he thinks. This must be the path to enlightenment, that jhana attainment I had as a child. And then he thinks, I thought, why am I afraid of that pleasure that has nothing to do with sensual objects or sensual pleasures and unwholesome qualities? I thought, I am not afraid of that pleasure, since it has nothing to do with sensual pleasures and unwholesome states. So, the point here, and this is part of that point made in the note at the back, is that for the first time, the Buddha divides pleasure into two aspects. Before, he used to think that all pleasure is bad, and he, for that reason, avoided it. But now he realizes that actually pleasure, not all pleasure is bad. It can be divided into two different categories. One category is the sensual pleasures, which distorts the mind, which makes you see things wrongly, you can't see clearly what's going on. But on the other side, you have the pittisukha, the happiness of the mind, that arises from meditation, from the jhanas in particular, from samadhi. And that pleasure is actually of a completely different quality than the sensual pleasure happiness, because there's no distortion of the mind there. In fact, it leads to the opposite. This is a happiness which leads to clarity and clear seeing. That is why it is a good kind of pleasure. So that is a very profound insight at this point, and this division into good and bad pleasures. And there are other suttas which talk about this division in more detail. And now, of course, comes he continues on, and he says, I considered it is not easy to attain that pleasure, in other words, the jhana pleasure, with a body so excessively emaciated. Suppose I ate some solid food, some boiled rice and porridge, I think is the right translation. Excuse me. Suppose I ate some solid food, some boiled rice and porridge. And I ate some solid food, some boiled rice and porridge. Now at that time, five bhikkhus were waiting upon me, thinking, if our recluse Gotama achieves some higher state, he will inform us. But when I ate the boiled rice and bread, the five bhikkhus were disgusted and left me, thinking, the recluse Gotama now lives luxuriously. He has given up his striving and reverted to luxury. So again, the ascetic striving, and this the point is really very clear here, that if you strive too much with ascetic practices, you are actually hindering your ability to have to attain samadhi. And that is what the point is being made here. So you have to abandon the ascetic striving, and you have to make sure that you have you are properly nourished and you are strong enough, and the body is not actually afflicted by painful feeling. And when the body is not afflicted, and the body is calm and peaceful, that is when that samadhi can arise, and the jhanas can arise. And you can see here how the group of five monks that were looking after him, they were disgusted, and they didn't want to look after him anymore. So that tells you something about the ideas of spirituality in India in those days. That was obviously the kind of the established idea of what spirituality is all about. And if you don't do that, well, then you are no good, and we're not going to support you anymore. So the Buddha actually had to break through that. He had to break through the conventions of the time and see things in a new way. And of course, that is what makes somebody a Buddha, that ability to see things in a new way and do things differently. So the Buddha then goes on. Now, when I had eaten solid food and regained my strength, then, quite secluded from sensual objects, secluded from unwholesome qualities, I entered upon and abided in the first jhana, which is made up of applied and sustained attention, made up of rapture and pleasure born of seclusion. But such pleasant feeling that arose in me did not invade my mind and remain. So now we are seeing the reverse side of what we saw before. Before we saw that the painful feelings not invade his mind and remain, he wasn't attracted to those. And now we are seeing the pleasant feelings not invading his mind and remaining. And usually when we talk about sense restraint, we talk about the restraint that relates to the five senses. And that is what sense restraint really is about. But at this very, very advanced level of the path, you also have to make sure that you don't, hold on to that happiness that comes from the jhanas. And because if you do grasp too much at that happiness, particularly when you come out afterwards and you start thinking, gee, that was really nice, wasn't it? I wish I could get that again. And you become really kind of craving for these things. And that craving in itself will then stop you from reattaining the jhana. It doesn't mean that the jhana itself is a bad state, and that this is where I think people often go wrong. They think that the jhana is bad because it can lead to craving for it. That's not the point. The point is that it's that craving afterwards which is bad and negative, because that is what stops you from going back into those states again in the future. So the Buddha here is saying that he avoided that craving for those pleasant states. And of course, now that we are talking about the jhanas here, as you move down the list and you get to the third jhana, you're talking about the highest possible pleasure that is attainable in samsara. You cannot attain anything higher than that. So just as we saw on the negative side, he attained the highest pain, now he's attaining the highest pleasure and showing that even that he's able to not allow that to invade his mind and remain. In other words, become attached to it and hold on to it and make it an obstacle for himself in his practice. With the stilling of applied and sustained attention, I entered upon and abided in the second jhana. With the fading away as well as rapture, I entered upon and abided in the third jhana. And this is the third jhana is the one with the highest sukha attainable. And with the abandoning of pleasure and pain, I entered upon and abided in the fourth jhana. With such pleasant feeling that arose in me did not invade my mind and remain. And then, now we are moving towards the enlightenment. When my concentrated mind was thus purified, right, unblemished, rid of imperfection, malleable, wieldy, steady, and attained to imperturbability, I directed it to the knowledge of recollection of past lives. I recollected my manifold past life, that is, one birth, two births, and he goes through this whole series of births, and then he says at the end, thus, with their aspects and particulars, I recollected my manifold past lives. This was the first true knowledge attained by me in the first watch of the night. Ignorance was banished and true knowledge arose. Darkness was banished and light arose, as happens in one who abides diligent, ardent, and resolute. But such pleasant feeling that arose in me did not invade my mind and remain. So, of course, a very important aspect here, and this is something you see in many suttas, is that when you recollect your past lives, it is not something which is just a byproduct or some kind of additional thing which is kind of something you can do or you don't have to do or whatever. It is actually called one of the three higher knowledges in Buddhism. It is a very important thing. It's a very important doctrinal aspect of the Buddha's teachings. And you see here, he says here, when you do recall your past lives, ignorance is banished and true knowledge arises. In other words, suddenly you're seeing the world in an entirely new way. And this new way is ignorance being abolished, darkness being banished, light arising. In other words, it is something which makes you see the world in a correct way, which helps you move toward enlightenment. There is another simile used as well for what is happening at this point, and that is the simile of breaking out of a shell. It's like this chick inside the shell hatching, and then suddenly, because of course when you're inside a shell, inside an egg, and you're hatching, inside the egg you're completely confined. You have no idea what's going on in the world, you don't understand what's happening. And recollecting your past life is said to be similar to this idea of hatching from an egg. Suddenly, you see actually what is true. You see the way the world actually is. You see samsara. You see what's happening here. And this, of course, gives you the chance to attain enlightenment. So this is very, very important and it's a very fundamental part of the Buddha's teachings. I like to stress this because this idea of rebirth is sometimes, I think, people don't really appreciate it enough how important and central it is in the Buddha's teachings. And yes. No, please. Okay. Imperturbability is usually the fourth jhana, and the first two immaterial attainments are called imperturbability here. And why that is, I don't think it's really explained anywhere. I think one of the reasons is because you have left all happy and painful feelings behind, and you have become completely equanimous. This is the highest type of mindfulness and the highest type of equanimity you can have. You get to that state in the fourth jhana. And I think that may have to do with imperturbability. In other words, there's no chance anymore of the mind being attracted to pleasure or even displeasure because you have found a pleasure which is higher than pleasure, if you know what I mean. And this is the hard part. You have to understand that equanimity is a higher pleasure than the experience of pleasure inside of you. That is the point. Oh. Not necessarily. I don't think it means that. And the reason I don't think so is because this is a standard expression in the suttas. You see that again and again. And it's a standard expression for the fourth jhana, that it is attained to imperturbability. And that is so, even if you are not an anagami, remember that a sotapanna is able to attain the fourth jhana. When a sotapanna attains the fourth jhana, he has attained to imperturbability. But it hasn't actually destroyed yet the fetter of karmachanda. So it doesn't necessarily mean that. I think you're on the right track. I'm not sure exactly where we are going, but I think you're basically on the right track. So. Okay. So anyway, let's move on to the next true knowledge. When my concentrated mind was thus purified, bright, unblemished, rid of imperfection, malleable, wieldy, steady, and attained to imperturbability, and directed it to the knowledge of the passing away and reappearing of beings. Thus, with the divine eye, which is purified and surpasses the human, I saw beings passing away and reappearing, inferior and superior, fair and ugly, fortunate and unfortunate, and I stood how beings pass on in accordance with their actions. This was a second true knowledge attained by me in the middle watch of the night. Ignorance was banished and true knowledge arose. Darkness was banished and light arose, as happens in one who abides diligent, ardent, and resolute. But such pleasant feeling that arose in me did not invade my mind and remain. So again, the second true knowledge, understanding, kamma, it's always important to understand that the way it is explained, understanding kamma, it doesn't just mean, we do something bad in this life and we feel the consequences afterwards in this life. The main understanding of kamma is about how kamma ripens in future lives. And that is what the Buddha is seeing here. He's seeing how kamma in one life affects your state in the future life. So that is the main understanding of kamma. So again, it has everything to do with rebirth. Kamma and rebirth go together. Without rebirth, kamma is reduced to something which is almost insignificant from a Buddhist perspective. It is rebirth which gives it the real significance. And again, it is something which gives rise to light. Light arose. Darkness is banished. Again, it's like a chick hatching from an egg. Suddenly you see what's going on. You understand the world properly. So again, it's something very profound and very important to understand these kind of things. And you can imagine what happens. Imagine that you see rebirth, you see yourself, your own past lives. You see that you go up and down, running around, now here, now there. There's nobody really in charge. You're not really in control of yourself. You are subject to the conditioning around you. The kamma you make depends on who your mates are in this life. And all these kind of things. And you're not really in charge. And then you get reborn in accordance with all that. And you are sort of, faring up, faring down, suffering and happy and all this kind of stuff. You can imagine that comes when you see that, you get this incredible feeling of being pushed away from this. You really don't want this. And this is called nibbida in the Pali. And nibbida has a sense of being pushed away. It's like the simile is like a feather. If you hold a feather against a flame, the feather tends to turn back from the flame. In the same way, you are pushed off samsara. You are. It's like a repulsion is maybe the technical word. You're repelled by the whole thing here. And you can see why. And it is necessary. And that's why the recollection of past lives and understanding the mechanism which drives the rebirth idea, why that is so important, because that is actually what gives you the motivation to end the whole business. So then the Buddha goes on, and now we're coming to the kind of the culmination here of the enlightenment or awakening experience. When my mind was thus purified, bright and blemished, rid of imperfection, malleable, wieldy, steady, and attained to imperturbability, I directed it to knowledge of the destruction of the taints. I directly knew as it actually is. This is suffering. This is the origin of suffering. This is the cessation of suffering. This is the way leading to the cessation of suffering. These are the taints, the asavas. This is the origin of the asavas. This is the cessation of the asavas. This is the way leading to the cessation of the asavas. When I knew and saw thus, my mind was liberated from the asava of sensual desire, from the asava of being, from the asava of ignorance. When it was liberated, there came the knowledge, it is liberated. I directly knew, birth is destroyed, the holy life has been lived, what had to be done has been done, there is no more coming to any state of being. So here you have the final, the very final part of the awakening experience. And again, he's basing himself on the fourth jhana. That is what this, when my mind was thus purified, means. It is the fourth jhana experience that he's basing this on. That is the most powerful experience in the suttas to base any kind of profound understanding on. And now he directs his mind to the knowledge of the destruction of the taints. In other words, at this point, he understands that existence itself is no longer interesting. He doesn't really want to exist anymore. I think that's what he has understood at this point. Because one of the taints is the asava of existence, which is so afterwards. And of course, if you're no longer interested in existence, and you turn your whole mind away from that, and then you can actually, that is how it is possible to destroy that attachment, that interest in existence, any kind of existence anywhere. And then, when you do that, that is when you have the breakthrough. And that breakthrough, you can see here, it consists of understanding the Four Noble Truths in two different ways. It is explained here. One way is understanding it in terms of suffering. That is the standard way of understanding the Four Noble Truths. Another way is understanding it in terms of the asavas being destroyed. And these two often go together when arahantship is described in the suttas. And it's possible, although I'm not 100% sure of this, excuse me, it is possible that the understanding of the Four Noble Truths in terms of the asavas is the understanding of the arahant. And that's why they always go together like that when arahantship, full awakening, is described in the suttas. Okay, so, and then of course, when he gets to that point, he knows that his mind has been liberated from the asava of being. Basically, the taint of being has been destroyed, means you have no more interest in being. You have no more interest in existence. Existence has become a pain, a burden, and you have gotten rid of that. That's what it means. And the same thing with sensual desire. You're absolutely no interest in anymore. You have destroyed any kind of desire for that world whatsoever. And the taint of ignorance, well, that simply means that you now see things as they actually are for the first time. You have got full understanding of reality here. And with that, and this of course is one of the very important points about awakening, with that destruction of all the asavas comes the knowledge. You know that the mind is liberated, first of all. In other words, you know that you're an arahant. This is not something that happens and you don't know about it. And you know that birth, you know that birth is destroyed. You know that there's no more state to coming to any state of being in the future. And of course, that is the most important description of arahantship in the suttas. And you see it again and again and again. Knowledge that there is no more future existence. And you have achieved the purpose of the Buddhist life, which is to not be reborn again in the future. And then the Buddha says, thus, this was the third true knowledge attained by me in the last watch of the night. Ignorance was banished and true knowledge arose. Darkness was banished and light arose, as happens in one who abides diligent, ardent, and resolute. For such pleasure, such pleasant feeling that arose in me did not invade my mind and remain. Of course, now he was an arahant, and it would be impossible for any pleasant feeling to invade the mind and remain. Just explaining this to this Satchaka. And then the Buddha goes on, Agivesana, I recall teaching the Dhamma to an assembly of many hundreds. Perhaps each person thinks, the recluse Gotama is teaching the Dhamma especially for me. But it should not be so regarded, that the Tathagata teaches the Dhamma to others only to give them knowledge. When the talk is finished, Agivesana, then I steady my mind internally, quieten it, bring it to singleness, and concentrate it on the same object of concentration as before, in which I constantly abide. So the point of this passage seems to be that Agivesana, of this Satchaka, is thinking here that the Buddha is teaching me all these things, you know, maybe I'm very important or something. Yeah. But the point the Buddha is making here is that there's obviously a large assembly around him, and he should not think that he's just teaching him personally. This is not a personal teaching that goes to him. It is a general teaching about truth that is for everybody who is in that assembly. And I have seen this happen myself in Bodhinyana Monastery. Sometimes Ajahn Brahm gives a teaching, and people come out afterwards, yeah, oh, he must have known what I was thinking, because he's teaching exactly what I needed to hear. But of course, that is not the case. I ask him, do you ever teach anybody specifically? He says, I never do that. And the point is that the Dhamma, because the Dhamma is a teaching which always is psychological, it always points to the problems in your mind and how you should deal with them, if you teach the Dhamma, it will happen that people will think that you're teaching just them, because it always fits with our experience, it always fits with the way we have to deal with the world to improve ourselves and to move forward on the spiritual path. So it is to be expected that you should feel that it hits home, because that is what the Dhamma is all about. But nothing to do with the speaker having any particular compassion on you or anything like that. Of course, he has compassion on you, but it's not kind of directed at individuals. It's directed at the group who he's teaching him. Yes. Yes, I will. Yeah. Okay. Yep. I don't actually know what that means, but I'll try to say something anyway. Yeah. Just one second. I'll get back to it, Jacob. Yeah. So yeah, an interesting thing here, and this is, I think, the point that we should keep in mind, is that the Buddha, the Dhamma, is always taught simply to give people an understanding of the path, and give them an understanding of the Dhamma, and to inspire them, and to get them going in their own practice. Sometimes you hear things like people say, oh, at the time of the Buddha, it was so easy, because the Buddha was around, and he would point to you exactly what your defilements were, and exactly what your problems were, and you would sort of just follow his advice, and everything would be there would be no problems, and you advance very quickly on the path. But in fact, what the Buddha is saying here, he didn't teach like that. He didn't teach individuals. He didn't say, this is what you should be doing. Well, certainly not when an assembly was there. Maybe it was a bit different when he was actually teaching an individual. But I think generally the Buddha taught to assemblies, not individuals. So sometimes it is not necessarily the case that it was all that much easier because the Buddha was around. It is not clear to me that the Buddha would have taught like that, where he told people individually what was their best practice. But sometimes we have to be careful with the kind of mythology that is being spread around. And to me, it seems like the sutta here is saying that this is exactly what did not happen. The Buddha just taught generally for people's knowledge and understanding. He did not teach specifically for your particular defilements, because all our defilements are basically the same. We're not that different from each other. It's not as if we require special teachings. We're all in the same boat together. In a way, that's nice. In one way, it is bad, because we feel like our individuality is somehow challenged. But that's a lot of that individuality is just a delusion anyway, isn't it? So it's not such a big deal. So then, Jacob, the state that this object that the Buddha concentrates on, to be honest with you, I don't know what that is, but I think presumably it means such things as the jhanas, for example, I would say here. Because the Buddha was known to abide in the jhanas after his enlightenment. And I think the commentary says that it is the fruition attainment of arahantship or something like that. And there are certain samadhis in the suttas which are very special types of samadhis, which are described in places like the Anguttara Nikaya. And it may have been one of those samadhis as well. But there's a whole range of possibilities there. And I don't think the Buddha may not mean a specific type of samadhi. I'm not sure whether he has a specific type of samadhi in mind, or whether it's just samadhi in general as a kind of group thing.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. Right. The Chula Sunga, this discourse on emptiness, and it talks about he abides with a mind that is constantly empty or something like that. Is that what you're saying? Yeah. I guess it could be that. But I think, of course, constantly here does not mean that this is happening all the time. What it means that as soon as he withdraws from the teaching engagement, then he goes back into that samadhi state. I don't think it means that this is a continuous thing which is always there. I think that is an important distinction here. Yeah. Okay, so let us move on and just finish off. We're coming towards the end here. And now comes Satchaka's challenge to the Buddha. And this apparently, according to the commentary, it was what he was trying to get to all the time, because he wanted to challenge the Buddha and see if he could get the better of him, so to speak. This can be believed of Master Gotama, since he is accomplished and fully enlightened. But does Master Gotama recall sleeping during the day? I recall Agivesana in the last month of the hot season, on returning from my alms round after my meal. I lay out my outer robe, folded in four, and lying down on my right side, I fall asleep, mindful and fully aware. And Satchaka says, some recluses and Brahmins call that abiding in delusion, Master Gotama. And the Buddha replies, it is not in such a way that one is deluded or undeluded, Agivesana. As to how one is deluded or undeluded, listen and attend closely to what I shall say. Yes, sir, Satchaka, the Nigantha son, replied. The Blessed One said this. Him I call deluded Agivesana, who has not abandoned the asava, the taints that defile and bring the renewal of being, give trouble, ripen in suffering, and lead to future birth, old age, and death. For it is with the non-abandoning of the taints that one is deluded. Him I call undeluded, or she, if you like, she I call undeluded, who has abandoned the taints that defile, bring renewal of being, give trouble, ripen in suffering, and lead to future birth, old age, and death. For it is with the abandoning of the taints that one is undeluded. The Tathagata Agivesana has abandoned the taints that defile, bring renewal of being, give trouble, ripen in suffering, and lead to future birth, old age, and death. He has cut them off at the root, made them like a palm stump, done away with them, so that they are no longer subject to future arising. Just as a palm tree, whose crown is cut off, is incapable of further growth, so too, the Tathagata has abandoned the taints that defile, etc., done away with them, so that they are no longer subject to future arising. So he's saying here that the mark of being deluded or undeluded is that you have abandoned the asavas of the mind, these things that basically make you look at the world in the wrong way, not understanding that existence itself is not actually something to be desired. It is something to be given up. When this was said, Satchaga, the Nigantha son, said, "It is wonderful, Master Gotama. It is marvelous how, when Master Gotama is spoken to offensively again and again, assailed by discourteous courses of speech, the color of his skin brightens and the color of his face clears, as is to be expected of one who is accomplished and fully enlightened." "I recall, Master Gotama, engaging Purana Kassapa in debate, and then he prevaricated, led the talk aside, and showed anger, hate, and bitterness. But when Master Gotama is spoken to offensively again and again, assailed by discourteous courses of speech, the color of his skin brightens, the color of his face clears, as it is to be expected of one who is accomplished and fully awakened." So here he is admitting that he's being a bit discourteous. And he's saying, of course, the point, of course, is that your mental state can be shows also in your outer appearance. So if you have a pure mind, it means that there will be some visibility of that purity in your complexion, in your facial expression, all these kind of things. And that is why the Buddha, because of the purity of his mind, he actually just engages with the person without any defilements arising. And I guess for that reason, he just brightens up and attends to what is happening rather than being defiled. Whereas other people who have defilements, if they get assailed by discourteous speech, etc., of course, they might get angry instead. Yes. Yeah. Well, I think it's very hard to say because all we have here are the words. But it may be that he was an argumentative fellow, you know, that he liked to argue. And that this kind of last question here, you know, oh, the Master Gotama, sounds like he's saying, you are deluded because you're sleeping in the day here. And I guess a lot of the question here is about, you know, how he said that and the kind of the circumstances around it. But the general feeling is that this guy was like a debater, and he sort of wandered around deliberately trying to sort of pull people's, you know, theses apart and destroy other people. That is what it comes across in the previous sutta to Satchaka. So you're right, it's not absolutely clear from the sutta that he was that discourteous. But it may, from the way he talks there, it sounds like he is implying that he was a kind of a pretty sort of, tough debater at the very least. Yeah, it's true. So, and that is the thing. It is one of the beautiful things I was talking about Kalyanamitta on Friday, about friendship. And there is a sutta in the Anguttara Nikaya, which Anagarika Kemanti at the Nuns Monastery pointed out to me. And that sutta has five qualities of somebody who is a good friend, the Kalyanamitta. And one of those qualities is called Vachana Kamo. Kamo means like being able to resist or being able to endure, and vachana is speech. So somebody who's able to endure speech, basically. So if somebody is argumentative, and this is the world, there are people out there who are argumentative, and they will enter debate because they just like to argue. And then you have to have that vachana kamo, where you are able to sort of endure that speech, and just go with the flow, and not get upset because somebody is argumentative. But it's also true that if somebody just, you know, all the only reason why they are debating the Dhamma is because they would like to argue, it can be very exhausting. They're not there to learn anything. They're not there to sort of, because they're interested in the Dhamma, all they're there for is to sort of show who, you know, one-upmanship and who is the best debater. Then that is very exhausting, because there's no feeling that you're actually, there's no purpose anymore to the debate. It loses entire purpose. And even the Buddha says that, you know, in certain discourses, that, well, these people are just here to tire me out because there's no purpose to the discussion there. So those are, there's some aspects there of that. Anyway, let's finish this sutta off. And then he also says, Satchaka, that he recalls meeting all these other people. And all of these people that are listed here, Makkali Gosala, Ajita Kesakambali, Pakudda, Kachayana, Sanjaya, Bilattiputta, Nigantanataputta, these are the kind of the main, or at least from the sutta's point of view, considered the main teacher of various sects in India in those days, in the north of India, I should say. So he engaged all of these in debate, and they prevaricated, led the talk aside for anger, hate, and bitterness. But when Master Gotama is spoken to offensively again and again, assailed by discourteous courses of speech, the color of his skin brightens and the color of his face clears, as is to be expected of one who is accomplished and fully awakened. And now, Master Gotama, we depart. We are busy and have much to do. Now is the time, Agyavesana, to do as you think fit. Then Satchaka, the Nigantha son, having delighted and rejoiced in the Blessed One's words, got up from his seat and departed. So there you are, that's the story of the Buddha. Don't treasure him. Sorry, just one second thing, I'll just get from John first of all, get back to you. Page 334, section 9, yeah? There isn't really very much description of development of the body in the suttas. It doesn't talk about that very much. But it seems from the description as it is described here, because it says that when painful feeling arise, he does not allow them to enter his mind, I think, and remain, or he doesn't become distraught and beat his breast and all these kind of things. In other words, it seems to me that it refers to sense restraint from what he's saying here. That is, I'm just basing myself on what it says here. It does occur in a few places in the sutta, this idea of being developed in body, but it's never really explained. I don't think it's an important part of the Buddha's teaching. It's just something that he had to talk about because it was a topic that was relevant in India, Indian spiritual society in those days. I don't think it's an important topic. But I think it refers to sense restraint and mindfulness, basically. Yes, thank you. The way it is described usually, the Buddha just says that once you come out of the fourth jhana, you just incline your mind in that direction. And because the mind is so powerful at that stage, it seems that just inclining it to the idea of remembering past lives, to the idea of seeing beings arising and passing away, the mind just goes there. It doesn't seem to be to require an enormous amount of practice or training. It seems to be a fairly natural thing that the mind does because it is so powerful. Right? I think, you know, the kasina is just a way of attaining jhanas, basically, of attaining samadhi in the suttas. Yeah. 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 Yeah, I think the kasinas are very marginal in the suttas. They're not important things. And I cannot remember whether there is any. Maybe there is one place or something in the whole canon which talks about kasina and related to this kind of knowledge. It may be. I can't even remember that clearly at the moment. But it is very marginal. It's not important. What is important is the fourth jhana. That's the one that matters. So. Yeah, just wait till you get there, and then you can, you know, because then you will know, and then you will understand probably why, how it works. Yeah. Okay, anything else before we call it a day? Yeah. Everybody happy? Do you want to ask a question? You want to ask after Winston, or you want to? Okay. Okay. Yeah, okay, yeah. Oh yeah, yeah. You're saying that he was the Nigantha son, and the Nigantha that put up wasn't practicing properly. To what was actually angry with him or whatever. Yeah. Well, I think there's two possibilities there. One possibility is that he was a Nigantha son, but now maybe he was moving away from that. That was why he was going to the Buddha. That's one possibility. Another possibility, which is maybe even more likely, is that last paragraph there is just a stock passage which is placed in there. And he may have mentioned one or two other people, and then that has been replaced over time with a stock passage talking about all the six teachers. Because that is the way the suttas often seem to have been collected, that, you know, they use stock passages everywhere. So that is probably one reason why that is happening. Okay, let's pay homage to the Buddha Dhamma Sangha.